the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. Info at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one, a look at some really extraordinary, innovative management practices in some of the most groundbreaking companies across the country. In part two, a look at the musical Urinetown. The final weekend of performance is coming up at Carthage College this weekend. Stay tuned. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with David Berkus, who is such a discerning voice when it comes to the whole world of management. He is actually an associate professor of management at Oral Roberts University, a regular contributor to Forbes magazine and Harvard Business Review. He speaks extensively to companies all across the country on various issues involving management. And he has written a new book, which is absolutely fascinating, called Under New Management: How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual. And in this book, David Berkus outlines some of the most dramatic ways in which some leading companies, and also a few companies you've scarcely heard of, have radically altered some of the oldest principles that have guided corporate management for a century. And it's quite intriguing. It doesn't mean that every single innovative practice might be right for the place where you work or the business that you own or operate, but there's all kinds of food for thought. And who knows, by the time you get to the end of this book, you might be seriously contemplating a way in which you can fold in some of these innovations into the place where you work. The book, again, is called Under New Management: How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And David Berkus, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. That was a great summary. I feel like, all right, thanks. That was awesome.
Good.
I don't know what I can say now.
Oh, I think we got lots to talk about. And starting with, for just a moment at least, the wonderful illustration on the cover of the book, in which we see the title, Under New Management, and right after it, the shift key of a computer keyboard. And of course, right there in a nutshell is at least part of what this book is all about.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what's funny is we debated whether to use a shift key or whether that was too old school and we needed to pick up something from like the smartphone world as a visual cue. But yeah, I mean, summarizes it beautifully. There's a shift happening that's just the nature of work changing. And then there's a shift that is intentional by many companies to do business and do management differently because the nature of work's changed. Not everybody's making that second shift, but everybody's making the first one. And if you don't make the second one, you're probably going to find yourself well managed to the point of being out of business.
I really appreciate how your book begins in the introduction with somebody that most of us have never heard of. I did not know the name Frederick Winslow Taylor at all, but it's good that we are introduced to him, or in some cases maybe reminded of who he was and why he was so important, and of some of the innovations which he helped create back around the turn of the last century, that is, as we flipped from the 19th into the 20th century. And you take the time to talk about him because many of the principles which he helped create remain in place in 2016. And probably in many, many cases, way past the point where they are useful principles or appropriate. Just in a brief nutshell, describe to our listeners the kind of things which he helped create more than a century ago and why it's important for us to appreciate him and yet at the same time discard some of his innovations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Frederick Taylor was, we forget that management was an invention, and Frederick Taylor was its inventor. You know, so in other words, you had a bunch of different people choosing to organize their largely factory work. This was Industrial Revolution time, however they wanted. And Frederick Taylor was the one that came in and said, no, there's a system, there's a process, there's a way we can experiment and find the best way to run a factory. And so he did a lot of that. A lot of the assumptions or recommendations that he made were based off the assumption that you had sort of two tiers of employee. You had management and you had labor. And labor did the work, but labor was sort of too short-sighted or outwardly too dumb to figure out how to do the work best. So it was management's job to train labor on how to do the work, and then labor is lazy, so it's management's job to measure and incentivize labor to keep doing the work at peak efficiency. And that's a big assumption we sort of drug with us from the factory to the office, where there are still these sort of two tiers, and we assume that even management knows more about how to do the work. But honestly, in a lot of modern organizations, a lot of the majority of people who work today probably know more about how to do whatever objectives they have to meet than do the person that they actually report to. So that begs this really important question. If these are the assumptions that we drug with us from factory to office, are they still serving us? The nature of work has changed, and so a lot of those fundamental principles need to as well.
Right, absolutely. One of the things you talk about in terms of how so many workplaces have changed so dramatically is in the drastic increase in mental labor or knowledge work, but that the tools of management have remained exactly the same. And that just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and you know, I think Frederick Taylor wouldn't even approve of it. So he was famous for, there's one instance where he figured out that a human could shovel exactly 21.5 pounds of coal to make an 8-hour shift of shoveling coal into a furnace, right? More than that, you'd burn out. Less than that, you're not being efficient. And there wasn't a shovel that could hold that exact weight, so he redesigned one and created one specifically for this task. And it's the same thing now. The nature of work has changed. We're not shoveling coal, but we are, I mean, our mind is on fire instead of the furnace. We're making decisions. We're coming up with ideas. We're solving problems. And the tools we're using weren't designed for that. They were designed for brute force, not mental energy. And so I think even Taylor would advocate that we start to reinvent these tools.
So you end up with over a dozen different notable innovations that you outline through the course of various chapters in this book. Was it tricky or difficult to come up with this list of 13? I suspect actually assembling the list wasn't as hard as maybe winnowing it down. I suspect there were probably many more innovative practices that you could have also talked about, and we would have been sort of overwhelmed by it all. But how tricky was that for you to kind of come up with this particular list as being especially important and potentially helpful?
Yeah, so I mean, that was actually literally the process, was winnowing down. So my training and my background is as an organizational psychologist. I teach organizational behavior and leadership classes at the university, and I saw a lot of these policies through that lens, right? Through the lens of what is the principle, what does the research say about human behavior that advocates for this position? So, I mean, to give you an example, there's a chapter there in sort of doing away with managers, not management as a task and a set of activities, but doing away with the person whose role is doing that and giving more autonomy to the frontline people. Well, I see that through a lens of a bunch of research and a model called self-determination theory that supports that when people are motivated to do the work, giving them more autonomy over how they do the work has bigger benefits than incentivizing them to do the work. So each of these ideas, it's not necessarily that these are the only new ideas out there. These are the ones that are new but have a long enough track record to see that it's working for the organization, but then also can be paired with research into human behavior, whether that's psychology or behavioral economics or neuroscience, any kind of scientific research that supports that here's why this idea is working and here's why it's better than business as usual.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with David Berkus, talking about his brand new book called Under New Management: How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual. And we're about to begin exploring some of the specific innovations which Professor Berkus has taken note of in various companies, and explains their success and the reason for their success, and also in some cases explains how certain innovations maybe didn't work so well for a particular company, not as well as they might have worked some other place, maybe because it wasn't quite as appropriate or maybe not implemented quite as carefully. One of the most audacious wildly surprising ideas is the one you give us in chapter one, the notion of outlawing email. And for those of us who sort of live and breathe email all day long, it's almost ludicrous to think about life without email. And yet you point out that a number of leading companies have at least to some extent done that, either eliminated email altogether or drastically restricted the time that their employees are allowed to access it. Talk for a moment about the kind of email pollution, as one CEO described it, that has led some companies to do this.
Yeah, so most of us have a love-hate relationship with email, right? We couldn't imagine doing work in 2016 without it. But at the same time, it frustrates us almost every day. And a lot of that is the nature of the tool itself, right? So email is wonderful because it's cheap and it's asynchronous. We can send a ton of it and we can send it whenever we want. But that's also the problem. We send a ton of it and we send it whenever we want. And one company, Atos, which is actually, they're an information technology and services company. So they're a tech company and they likened it to pollution. Their people were overwhelmed with email messages and it wasn't the best medium for conveying information-rich dialogue. It wasn't the best place to have a lot of conversations that we're having. So they decided that they would work towards becoming a zero internal email company. So they still, collaborate with customers and external relationships because you can't really change them. But internally, they're gradually moving towards from email towards a system that they set up to manage internal communication and towards old school technologies like the telephone and the face-to-face conversation, a revolutionary concept, I know. So most companies aren't going that route, but a lot are starting to realize and starting to have the conversation that because it's cheap and because we send it whenever we want, we're getting a ton of it, we're getting it at all hours, and that's a problem. And some people like to work at 11 o'clock at night, other people like to sleep at 11 o'clock at night, other people like to enjoy family time, whatever it is. And so many companies have basically decided that, okay, we're still going to use email, but we need to restrict it like we would an office phone. You know, if you called my office phone during off hours, I'm not here. You can't get a hold of me. We need that same barrier to give people rest time, to give them time with family, to keep them from burning out. And so one company in particular actually shuts off the email server. So if you wanted to send an email at 10:30 at night, you can still compose the email. You can still do the work if that's what works for you, but it will stay in your outbox until 8 o'clock the next morning when business hours start again, and then it will hit someone's inbox. So you're not disturbing the people who choose, no, that's an hour I don't want to work. Now, I think that's a great sort of medium between banning it entirely and still figuring out, you know, we need this tool. But really, it's not necessarily about what you choose to do. It's about having a conversation. We adopted this tool without ever talking about what are the best ways to use it, and only now we're realizing that probably wasn't a good idea. Let's have that conversation.
Right. I appreciated the observation of the CEO of a company called Evernote, who said, email is fine if you're getting two or three a day. It was never meant for anything like the volume we currently see. And so for those of us who end up with inboxes with tens of thousands of messages stacking up, if we're not meticulous about keeping track of such a thing, you end up really being overwhelmed and missing important emails and not even knowing what to do with all the others. It's something that's gotten terribly out of control.
And being distracted throughout the day, right? I mean, there's a lot of research that supports that when you're in doing deep work and you're disrupted, it takes about 15 minutes to get back to the level of thinking that you were. And if you think about it, Outlook checks for email every 5 minutes. So will you ever get back? Because there'll probably be another email 5 minutes later to disrupt you again.
In chapter two, speaking of revolutionary ideas, you serve up the possibility that just seems crazy on the surface of a company not putting the customers first, but in fact upending that scenario and putting their own employees first, looking after their own needs before then looking to the needs and the wants of their customers. As you describe how this was done at a place called HCL Technologies, you describe how it was because of some interactions from customers that that this innovation was created. And not in the way that we might think. It's not that these were customers who were incredibly unpleasant and or negative in any way, but for a very surprising sort of reason. Explain that.
Yeah, so what HLC Technologies was realizing was that, you know, there's that old saying, the customer is always right. And while that aim is noble, that goal is true, because the customer and the interaction between customer and firm is where all the value is created, most company structures are built to kind of create a divided loyalty on that front line that interacts with the customer. So in other words, you're responsible to the customer, yes, but you're also managed by somebody. You may also have to report to several other people, other departments. And those functions create an accountability across multiple domains and make it harder for you to do what you need to, in order to serve the customer, in order to put the customer first. So what HLC Technologies decided is they labeled that the value zone. Any position that interacted with the customer is where we create all of our value. And so any other position ought to be seen as accountable to that front line. So this looks like turning the hierarchy at least on its side, if not upside down entirely. And the research supports this. It turns out that the best predictor of profits is customer loyalty, but the best predictor of customer loyalty is employee satisfaction. In other words, companies that put those frontline employees first and trust that those employees will put customers first see a much longer lasting and more valuable increase in customer loyalty than do ones that say the customer is always right, so we're going to hold you accountable, but we're going to divide your loyalty and we're going to just leave you confused. It's really about putting employees first so they can put customers first, not just saying the customer is always right, but you're also accountable to us, we're also always right. And that just creates confusion and ultimately results in disaster.
Right. Because so often, if the customer is always right, then it is these sort of frontline employees in the trenches who end up bearing the brunt of their dissatisfaction. They get criticized for not satisfying those customers or making things right or whatever. And somehow that there is something to be said for a scenario in which one is safeguarding one's own employees first so that they can in turn give the very best possible service to their customers.
Yeah, and I mean we all as consumers, we've probably all been in a customer service situation where we're dissatisfied, and so what do? We ask for that person's manager. And most of the time, what does that manager do? Well, they either throw that frontline employee under the bus and say they were wrong and I apologize, or they're able to access some resource or some possible solution that that frontline employee couldn't do. And so now the customer looks at that frontline employee as totally invaluable. Well, imagine what that does in the long term to those employees. It sends that message that you don't actually have the power to make customers successful. So it's better if managers say, you know, we have these frontline employees back, even to the point of inviting some percentage of customers to decide to shop elsewhere, decide to be a consumer of a different company because they're not a right fit for our culture. That ultimately, to that target market, creates a much better situation where those employees can put those customers first.
Right. And then when you have that situation at a place like Wegmans, because it is a great place to work, its workers make it a great place to shop. Real quick, can you say a word about something in this chapter when you mentioned that the mistake that gets made in terms of this sort of mindless devotion to whatever the customer wants, no matter what, that this is often a mistake made when a company becomes successful and grows too quickly? How are those two things connected?
So often, you know, when a company first starts, everyone is in that value zone, right? Everyone's interacting with the customer because there's only four of us, right? Or there's only one of us, right? But as we grow and as we add levels, obviously, those people who are in the front line, those are the ones that tend to grow up with the organization. So those are the founders, those are the people who were there from the beginning, and those are the people that we're now hiring new people on the front line, which I think sends a really intriguing message about the importance of that front line value zone, right? If we're just replacing that with cogs in the cycle, then maybe it's not as important as we value it. But the other thing that it creates is it creates a mentality that we used to do this job 20 years ago when we were a smaller firm, so we clearly know how to do the job best now. Well, the best leaders, the best senior managers are the ones who are open to the idea that things change and they need to change as well, and that the value zone, that frontline employees, have the best source of information for what customers are wanting right now. But often as a company grows, the people who used to be on the front line maintain this idea that they still sort of know best, even if the customers have the best source of information, or excuse me, the front line has the best source of information.
Hmm. I was quite intrigued by the chapter on vacation policy and learning about how companies like Netflix have essentially done away with the standard vacation policy. They really have no vacation policy there whatsoever. And you explain how, in a way, it makes perfect sense at a place like Netflix because of the way that their just general work schedule is set up. Explain why this makes a great deal of sense at a place like Netflix, and perhaps at some other companies too.
Yeah, so early on in Netflix's ethos, and they became a company by the nature of their work, where people sort of worked around the clock. They were a results-only environment. If you were the type of person that wanted to come in at noon and work till 8, that was fine. A lot of people would work a little bit at home and a little bit at the office, and some people would even kind of travel away and be spending vacation days, but also working a little bit in order to get their objectives done and those sort of things. It became an environment where they weren't tracking what people were doing when they were in the office, weren't tracking what times they started working, what times they stopped working, regardless of where they were. But they had a traditional vacation policy. You get X number of days per year and use them or lose them, that type of thing. And the employees pushed back, and they asked Reed Hastings, the founder, you know, you don't track the days that we're here. Why are you tracking the days that we're not here? And he didn't have a good response. He sensed that people felt like this was an area where they weren't being trusted, and instead they were being sort of nitpicked and micromanaged, and so he eliminated it. And a lot of people call this the unlimited vacation policy, but it's actually a vacation non-policy, right, a no vacation policy, because he just did away with it. And he said, in that, you can no vacation policy doesn't mean no vacation. It just means we trust you to take what you need, to not take what you don't need, to not abuse the system. And it turns out there's a lot of research that supports that when people feel trusted, they're more likely to respond with trustworthy behavior. And that's exactly what happened at Netflix. In fact, shortly after Netflix adopted this policy, they later changed their expense report policy to one that was the default to trust. They changed it to 5 words long: act in Netflix's best interest. I mean, you could even shorten that even more to, we trust you.
Right. You write at one point, the idea is to expect adult behavior from employees, then deal with those who can't act like adults without burdening the majority. A really interesting point you make is that this, although there's a simplicity to this no vacation policy, that the company does provide some guidance to its employees on how to responsibly act within that freedom. And of course, that makes a great deal of sense.
Yeah, and the other thing I have to emphasize is Netflix in particular and the companies for which this work, they were very showy about when senior lead managers and et cetera were taking vacations. So there wasn't this subtle culture of, oh, we have an unlimited vacation policy, that means we expect you to always be working. It was celebrating the idea that everybody needs vacation. But you're right, there were guidelines for, okay, here's how much lead time we would need to know if you're taking a long vacation. The longer the vacation you take, the more advance notice we need in order to do this responsibly. But we'll give you however much you need.
You go on to explain in this chapter how this did not work out so well at Tribune Publishing, right down the road from us in Chicago. And it has it's sort of a devil in the details sort of story. I don't think we need to go into too much of the particulars. But I appreciated the fact that your book is not just a list of great innovations and why aren't you jumping aboard this bandwagon. But periodically, there are these moments that are, in a sense, points of caution. That not every innovation is likely to work equally well in every kind of company, and that matters like details and implementation can also derail what might seem like a great idea on the surface.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. You know, I had to recognize that for unlimited vacation and for some of these other ideas, not everybody who tries it makes it work, and there's a lesson there. You know, we can learn from comparing the successes and the failures and figure out what was going on here that allowed this company to have it thrive and this company to have it not. In the case of Tribune, it came down to a sort of a trust issue. In the fine print was this idea that as we transition from a normal paid time off system to an unlimited vacation, you're not going to get paid for the paid time off that you already accrued before we make the switch, and you're not actually going to be in unlimited vacation until you spend all of those paid days off. And so, in other words, a lot of employees were saying, well, all of this thing that we earned before under the old system, you're stealing. And so this new policy was perceived as you're basically trying to steal from us. And so there was blowback, and they ultimately had to go back to the old system. Not that unlimited vacation itself wouldn't work, but the way that they were doing it wasn't seen as an act of trust on behalf of senior leaders to employees. It was seen as something else, and that's sort of the reason it broke down. I mean, the truth of unlimited vacation days is that it's not actually about the vacation days at all. It's about how are you communicating trust to your employees, and how are they responding with trustworthy behavior.
Right. And it's interesting how a bedrock principle like trust sort of emerges out of so much of this conversation and so many of these varied innovations. I mean, in a sense, your book is about a lot of different things. And on the other hand, your book is about one or two really big things playing out in some different ways.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, that was the fundamental assumption that we drug with us from Frederick Taylor and the factory to the office, was that employees can't be trusted. It's management's job to monitor and to train them and all of those sort of things. Well, that's not really true anymore. The nature of work is such now that most people who are doing the work know more about how to do the best work than does management. So the only logical response is to respond with trust. We trust you to do the work. If you don't do it, we'll deal with you on a case-by-case basis. But we're not going to make a policy that communicates distrust because one person is taking advantage of it.
One of the most surprising ideas is this notion of paying people to quit. Real quick, describe this scenario to our listeners.
So this is exactly what it sounds. Shortly after primary training, companies like Zappos will say, here is the performance expectation, here's our company culture. You wouldn't have gotten this far if we didn't think you were a fit, but if you don't think you're a fit, we're going to make it easier for you to make that decision now instead of 6 months or a year from now when performance issues have cost us a lot of money. So we'll offer you, usually it's about a month's salary across a lot of different companies. It's different dollar figures, but it works to be about almost a month's severance right off of primary training to self-select out now. And I think this works great not only because a very small percentage of people do that, but because most people don't. And most people make the decision, no, I'm going to stick this out even at the face of this money, and are hence even more committed to making that new job work, making this new company work, because otherwise they would have taken the money and run.
Hmm. You have ideas here about work appraisals and about non-compete clauses and how to hire, how to fire, the importance of sabbaticals, the environment in the office, all kinds of ways in which we can think about and rethink how we work and how we manage those who work for us. The book again is called Under New Management: How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and the author David Berkus. Professor Berkus, I really enjoyed your book and our conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this weekend offers up your final opportunities to experience an exciting main stage musical at Carthage College. This is the second and final weekend of performances of the intriguing musical Urinetown. And this is one of those works that really ranks high in the minds and hearts of musical theater folk, especially performers who always relish the opportunity to be in this show, which, among other things, takes inspiration and also, in a sense, sort of pokes fun at some of the really significant works of the stage that have come before it, and all the while telling its own really compelling story, and a story that resonates on a lot of different levels. It's timely in a lot of different ways. So there are a lot of reasons to come and experience Urinetown, and not least of which because it has a marvelous director at the helm, Mary McDonald Kerr. And some of you may know her from the extensive work that she's done in the Milwaukee area over the last 20 years or so with organizations like Next Act Theater, the Renaissance Theater, Milwaukee Chamber Theater. She was saying that people very likely may have seen her in a couple of different performance runs of Sheer Madness. And she has just now directed her first show at Carthage. And she's brought with her to the morning show today two students at Carthage, whom I know very well from all that they've done at Carthage. They are both seniors. Christian Aldridge, who performs the role of Caldwell B. Cladwell, and then Sean Kelly, who performs the role of Bobby Strong. They are, in a sense, villain and hero in the show Urinetown. So a warm welcome to all three of you.
Thank you. Yeah,
thanks, Greg.
Good to have all of you here. Mary McDonald Kerr, just tell us how you first hooked up with Carthage College. How did this opportunity sort of come your way?
Well, live in Paddock Lake and have done so for over 20 years, and have known of Carthage College mostly because of its Christmas choir program. Mm-hmm. And I work frequently with First Stage Theater in Milwaukee, and one of the artistic associates there is John McClay, who also is part of the theater faculty at Carthage, and we talked frequently about trying to get me to come there and work, and he introduced me to Martin, and I got a phone call about a year after that introduction asking me if I wanted to direct the spring musical, which was kind of shocking to me because I've directed quite a bit, but never a musical. And so, and then I was given the opportunity to choose which musical it was, and I have been a longtime lover of You're in Town, so when they said yes to that, I was really excited.
Wow. Just say a word about how different it is to direct a musical versus a straight play. We should probably hasten to add that there is a music director who actually mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. most of the hands-on responsibility for musical matters, but nevertheless, I assume that it feels a little different than some of the other directing you've done.
Yes. First of all, one of the reasons I picked Urinetown was because it would had the opportunity for the most students possible to be involved. So there are 27 cast members and a pit orchestra. And so just the size of staging that many people on at once is very different. I tend to direct, three four-handers because the theaters in Milwaukee are all poor and want to direct very small show as possible. So just having that many people on stage was very different. I have a lovely choreographer, Brittany Coriacci, who I worked hand-in-hand with deciding what kind of choreography we would use, but she was ultimately responsible for creating that. And yes, we have had a music director, Amy Haynes, who has been kind of responsible for maintaining the integrity of the singing. And but I made a lot of the character choices when it came to the music and how it works. It's just bigger is all. Mm. But we decided early on that the core of it still needed to have just as much truthful integrity and, as any play, as any Shakespeare play, as any Mamet play, that I took it that seriously when it came to how we told the story, even though it's hilarious. So there were a lot of commonalities in the final product that I was delighted to discover.
Mm. So tell our listeners who don't know You're in Town at least a little bit about its storyline.
Well, don't be scared of the title. it was written in 2001. It premiered in 2001 by Greg Kotis and Mark Holman, who I believe Mark Holman got the idea when he was backpacking across Europe and had to pay to get into a public bathroom, and he got the idea of how crazy it would be to live in a society where the use of a private bathroom was made illegal and that you had to pay to use the bathroom. So he created this story of a society where the drought has been going on for so long and is so severe that that's what's happened. The 99 percenters have to pay to use the bathroom and the very rich do not. And it's a satire of corrupt politics and the way we are flip about our natural resources and the have and have nots. And also hand in hand with that is a parody / love affair with the American musical in it. And there's a lot of winking at the audience about what we love about a musical. And it refers to lots of popular musicals throughout with various numbers.
Very good. We'll talk about some of those specifics in a moment. Let's learn about the two characters who are represented by the two young actors that you have brought with you today, Sean Kelly and Christian Aldridge. Sean, let's start with you and your character of Bobby Strong. Who is Bobby and what is he like?
I have the fortune of playing Bobby, and it's just been, I just would like to say, it's been so much fun to discover him each and every day and to play. So Bobby is... He works at the filthiest urinal in town, and he is the custodian, the assistant of Pennywise, which is the urinal owner. And she's a very tough woman. Bobby is that young dreamer that is similar to everyone else, but there's just something different about him. Everyone likes Bobby. Lockstock, which is the narrator of the show, he even comments on the fact that, you know, everyone loves Bobby. Bobby has this awakening in scene 3 or 4, which is with the song Follow Your Heart, and he meets this girl named Hope Gladwell, which is the daughter of Caldwell. And he's never seen such a beautiful girl in this part of town, and he just becomes awakened to his mission. We talked about how Bobby represents love in the show. And he knows what he needs to do once he sees this girl, once he sees the love of his life. And in that moment, he starts this revolution. He's been, you know, day after day, he's seen the injustices of these people that just suffer from having to pee or from having to pay to use the bathroom, and many can't do it. And his Bobby, or his father in the first scene, gets taken away because he doesn't have enough coins to pay for it. So he gets taken away by the policeman, and he sees, you know, this madness, and he wants to stop it. He wants to do something. And when he sees Hope, she inspires him to do so. And then Act 2 moves a little faster. He starts his revolution. Not everything's great. That's what's great about this show. It's not like a traditional musical.
Right. Kind of complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
You've already mentioned the name of Caldwell, namely Caldwell B. Cladwell. Christian Aldridge, tell us about him.
Well, Caldwell B. Cladwell is a very interesting character, probably one of the most interesting characters that I've had the opportunity to play, and very different from any of the roles that I've played before. He is a wonderfully powerful man. He is responsible for the preservation of the water in this community, to come at it from a good guy perspective. He has enforced the rules that everyone must pay to use public restrooms, because he was alive during what the characters call the stink years, which is the beginnings of the drought. As he says in the show, the water table started to drop and then just kept dropping, and people did questionable things because they thought there was no tomorrow. And he found that he was willing to fight for tomorrow, and did so by enacting certain methods, like paying to pee, that preserve the water. Now, of course, that's come to be seen as an awful thing because it's, you know, makes people miserable. And to be truthful, he is a bit of a greedy man. He's maybe taking a little more money than he needs, and he certainly enjoys having the power to do with it whatever he pleases. But the fact remains that his methods are what control water consumption in this community. So there's to come at it from a little bit of a defense of Caldwell B. Cladwell.
So do you resist the temptation to think of him as the villain in this piece? Is that simplistic to think of him that way?
I guess you can still definitely think of him as the villain. As when I'm doing the character work, you never want to assume that your character is the villain, right? In a play like this, it's a little more complex because it is a parody of function in a musical, right? So there are certain characters that function as the villain and function as the typical hero, right? So you do have to acknowledge that. But when you're coming at it, like Mary said, from a more truthful standpoint, the character has to believe that what he's doing is right, whether it's villainous or not. So that's sort of how I've come at this particular character.
Tell us about the music that both of you get to sing. What is this musical score like? And Mary already mentioned the fact that this show pays homage to some of the great shows that have come before it. Does the score do that very directly? I mean, are you at some point singing music that really sounds like it's come from another show?
Absolutely. When we started rehearsing the music in March, We talked about this idea of a pastiche, which is a musical tribute to something from the older musical canon. So throughout the show, you can compare these music numbers directly to older musical songs. So I just think of Snuff the Girl, which is in Act Two, and it's when, you know, the riot, the revolution is happening, and the poor community have Hope as hostage, and they do this Fosse dance number, and then they start snapping, and they're doing all these moves that would remind you of West Side Story, but at the same time, this whole Fosse dance style. There's a Les Mis moment when the revolution is marching and the flag comes out, and there's all these tributes to these older musical shows. And
there are some musical themes that are started with the opening numbers that do carry through to the end that I think are kind of Urinetown's own. But then within that bookends, there are almost every song sounds like a completely different show. You know, there's a West Side Story moment, there's a Fiddler on the Roof number, there's Les Mis, there's a Pajama Game with Mr. Cladwell, and the dance styles, the choreographer, we did such a great job of researching all of those. So every number looks different. It's not, you know, you're in the same world because it's the same people, obviously, in the set and the costumes, but they are transported to these different places where even if you're not a musical fan, you will recognize it. You might not know why you recognize it, but you will recognize the vocabulary of how it's going to go, what the pace is going to be, when the boy meets girl love song happens. You recognize it. You might not go, oh, that's exactly this reference, but because those references are in television and commercials and cartoons, and they're just saturated in the media that we see. And it's been really fun to me because I'm a big fan of the older traditional musicals like Guys and Dolls in Oklahoma. And so to get to do a fairly modern piece, but that whose roots are in the older stuff has been really wonderful.
That sounds like something that in lesser hands could kind of turn into a mess. I mean, it could really be just kind of a chaotic blur and have no sort of identity of its own, but it sounds like you feel very good about, you know, the creators of this musical, that they've done a really good job of doing that.
Masterful job. And not only is that all going on, but it's written in the kind of Bertolt Brecht style of, you know, in your face, no fourth wall. Direct address by the heroes. The reason his name is Bobby Strong is because of this Brechtian style. All of the characters are named of what they're supposed to be. It's very obvious. You know, Hope is the ingenue's name, and that's what she is. She's one just giant ball of hope. And Bobby is strong, and he's Cladwell because he's so rich. And Pennywise is stingy, and so those kinds of traditions. And the narrator, who is the cop who is written in this great film noir dialect, and he takes the audience through. And there's no hiding of the fact that you're at a play. You're told by the first character, the first lines, welcome to the musical. This is what's going to happen in Act One. This is what's going to happen in Act Two. And that tongue-in-cheek winking at the audience of don't forget you're at a musical and we're actors continues through the whole show, and it's very, very funny. It sounds like a really odd premise, but it's very funny. And unfortunately, what you were saying earlier, it's very timely. Addressing. I didn't set out to make this a parody of that at all, but I think of Cladwell being Donald Trump and Bobby being Bernie Sanders, the opposition of those two giant ideas, and how I'm not sure neither of them work. You know, those extreme wants for society and how they bump heads.
I'm curious about the matter of kind of a weighty social message. I mean, like the message of social justice and equality for all and so on. Because on the other hand, it sounds like the creators of this musical are having a lot of fun with it and so on. So, I mean, do you feel like you're experiencing this this sort of weighty musical with this weighty message, or is it too much fun to deliver a big message? What do you think about that?
Oh, well, I think it's a really solid balance, actually. excuse me. There are, as you said, it is so much fun. It's you'll find yourself laughing at these things throughout the show, and then realizing, oh, that's terribly dark. That's actually really awful, and yet I'm cracking up about it. I'm and you know I saw this show years and years ago back when I was in high school. I should say years and years. It's been not that long.
Everything's relative.
Yeah, right. Everything's relative. And I fell in love with it then. And even then, I was like, wow, this is like the coolest parts about this show are that it takes parody and then suddenly really painful truth and mixes it all together. And like Mary said, it's done masterfully. Like the guys who wrote this knew precisely what they were doing, and it shines. So I think people coming to see it should not expect to be beaten over the head with a message, but to acknowledge that they have found a message at some point. I don't think it's beaten over them at all.
Right. And if you want to deliver a message, that's probably the best way to do it.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The doors of resistance don't slam shut. I've seen You're in Town only once. It was at Carthage, but it was done as more of a workshop production in the recital hall. So I don't know if that was before your time, probably. Mm-hmm. So I look forward to now seeing it in all its splendor as a main stage musical. It's going to be fun to see that. Before we let everybody go, since both Sean and Christian are seniors, I think we should find out a little bit about what you are hoping to do in this next step once you have graduated from Carthage, which will be coming up in just a couple of months. Sean?
Well, actually, I got really, really lucky. I landed a job through an audition I went to in Memphis, Tennessee, which was called the UPDAS. And it's for professionals that will be graduating this spring. So they're hiring for year-round work. And so I'll be working as kind of like an intern resident actor with the Charleston Stage Company, which is in Charleston, South Carolina. So I will be in 7 to 9 shows throughout their season. I know they're doing Hairspray, so I'll get to play Link in Hairspray. And then I'll also learn how to work alongside some theater educators and get some theater teaching experience. Wow. So it's great. Yeah,
terrific. Christian?
Well, I a little closer to home for me, I auditioned for a production of an outdoor theater production of Romeo and Juliet. This summer in Waukegan, Illinois, at Three Brothers Theater. So I'll be playing Romeo in my first professional production.
Wow.
And that's very exciting. Aside from that, I'm still auditioning, and I look to stick around the Milwaukee, Chicago area for a while and try to be a part of the best theater that I've seen in my life.
Very good. Well, it's a great place to do theater, and Mary McDonald Carey, you know all about that, don't you?
I do. It's been a wonderful home. I worked in Chicago for 8 years and then got married and decided to move to the country and didn't even really know about Milwaukee Theater and auditioned there on a whim and ended up having been steadily employed there for 20 years. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful community. And this is an amazing place. There's more theater per capita in Milwaukee, I think, professional theater than any city in the country. The support that this area gives to the arts is kind of astounding.
Well, we're glad your busy schedule allowed you to come down to Carthage for what sounds like the happiest of collaborations with the musical You're in Town. And its final performances are tonight, Friday night, Saturday night, 7:30 at Wartburg Auditorium on the campus of Carthage College. Mary McDonald Kerr, the director, Christian Aldred, and Sean Kelly, two of the actors, thanks for being here and best wishes with this final performance weekend of You're in Town.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on the morning show, among other things, we'll be talking about UW Parkside's production of Gogol's great play, The Government Inspector. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate